History Show with Moz Duncan.
Good evening and welcome to the History Show on RTE Radio 1. On this week's programme, the RIC and where they fit into our complex and contested history. We'll discuss the recent commemoration controversy and what it spells for the future in this decade of remembrance. Also, on the subject of the Royal Irish Constabulary.
One report said he was hit with a stone, fell forward and broke his nose, never regained consciousness. There was another one said he was hit with a stick.
We'll hear a story from Donegal in 1889, a violent episode involving an RIC inspector, a parish priest and his parishioners. Plus,
it had the snow effect, but it didn't deter people from watching programmes on it because it was always exciting to see this newfangled thing called television, you know.
The arrival of television in Ireland. How society changed with the introduction of private screens. It's 51551 for your texts and at RTE History Show on Twitter. It's great to be back for another season of the History Show at a time when our revolutionary history is very much a current affair. As you know, while we were off the air and just as the decade of centenaries rolled into 2020, the government's plan to commemorate the Royal Irish Constabulary and the Dublin Metropolitan Police with an event at Dublin Castle sparked an angry response. That event, which was ultimately cancelled, provoked outrage among many, led some politicians to threaten to boycott the ceremony, and gave rise to a vigorous debate, a debate which played out over the RTE airwaves.
It's a very political and emotive stance that the state have taken. I don't know what other country would do. It's very upsetting, you know, as a citizen.
I believe in a measured sense this is an appropriate way to mark a very difficult and contested part of our history, and that's not to dispel that atrocities were carried out by the RIC.
Instead, we should be up front celebrating the revolutionaries who threw the brutality and the oppression out of the country.
It's nothing about black and tans or auxiliaries. What we're commemorating is the sacrifice made by individual RIC men.
This could damage the further process with some very difficult issues like the handling of the Civil War.
You know, revisionism is important, balance and counterbalance is important, but sometimes I think you can go too far and you have to shout stop.
Amongst bad people you have good people, and amongst good people you have bad people. You only need one bad egg in any barrel to make the rest of the eggs look bad.
Five one double 51551 for your text. Just a few of the voices there that commented on the RIC commemoration controversy as it played out back in January. I'm joined in studio by three guests. Jim Herlihy is one of the voices that you heard there. He's with the Historical and Reconciliatory Police Society here and after to be referred to as HARP, as mentioning Historical and Reconciliatory Police Society is way above my pay scale at this stage. It's a mouthful. Brian Hanley is an historian and author. Also joining us is archivist Katrina Crowe. You're all very, very welcome indeed. Now, Jim, you were seen as the primary mover and supporter of this initiative. Given all that's happened, what are your plans? Do you think, or are you hoping, that this is only a postponement, that this might actually happen at some point in the future? Or if it doesn't happen, are you going to to promote an event of your own, a commemoration of your own, of the RIC and the DMP?
We're going to continue with the HARP Society, and we have an interdenominational service since 2013, every September, roughly in line with the disbandment of the RIC, because they were disbanded formally on the 31st of August 1922. And we're going to continue with that. And all we're going to do is just only read out the casualties of the War of Independence. And it's completely interdenominational.
And would that not have been the best way to do it in the first place?
Not necessarily. I think there's the way it's been handled in the decade of centuries has absolutely been shambolic, from especially 2016, when the very first casualty in 1916... James O'Brien, an unarmed policeman, it couldn't be more definitive.
That was in Dublin Castle.
A shot dead at Dublin Castle. Completely unarmed, in uniform, and he wasn't remembered. And this, even the second one, allegedly killed by Countess Markovitz. not remembered. All those casualties weren't remembered. So we thought at that stage that there would be that nothing was going to be done. It was more.
Was there not an implication, though, with the 1916 commemoration that we were commemorating everybody who died in 1916?
That was
civilians as well.
That was my understanding. And that didn't.
But you don't think that's actually what happened?
Not in relation to the police, no, absolutely not.
Did they not go on the wall in Glasnevin, Jim?
Well, they went on from 19. Yeah, that's all that has happened.
Well, that's commemoration. That's
Dublin Castle, there was a ceremony in 2016 at which relatives of the dead policemen were present, along with relatives of the Citizens' Army and so on. And to be honest, Jim, I read quite a lot about the police in 2016. I mean, it's not the case that they've been forgotten. There has been quite a lot of strident voices in the media, quite rightly, who have continually brought up the service of the RAC and the DMP and all the rest of it. And I think it was impossible to have this commemoration in 2020 and not deal with the fact that the RIC by 1920 comprised the Black and Tans and the Auxiliaries. And for people to argue it was nothing to do with them, it was just about the Irish police, was wrong. There couldn't be a commemoration without including those forces.
I mean, isn't that the point, Jim, that whether you like it or whether you like it not, that if you were a Black and Tan, you were a member of the Royal Irish Constabulary? Now, maybe you had your own unit, maybe you quote-unquote fought in your own unit, you were still a member of the RIC.
I never separated them at any stage, and neither did the Harp Society at any stage separate the two.
That means we would have been commemorating members of the Black and Tans and the Auxiliaries in January in Dublin Castle.
No, we would commemorate all people killed on duty, all those that were killed in 1916, all those who were going to be killed or were killed in the War of Independence.
That's hugely problematic, though, Jim. In Dublin Castle. By 1920, the Dáil was up and running. Sinn Féin had won a majority. They had expressly, you know, tried to set out to create a counter-state to the British state in Ireland. Many Irish policemen were unhappy with service in the British state. Some of them resigned, some of them, as you know, and you have chapter and verse on this, you actually know far more about it than me from your own research, the number of Irish policemen who were working for the revolutionary movement undercover. But the British government, and here I would even draw a distinction between, say, British soldiers in 1916 who didn't know where they were being sent and who had very little choice in the matter. The Black and Tans and the Auxiliaries volunteered to come to Ireland expressly to put down a rebellion. They were very well paid to do so, and they were part of the police, as you know yourself, and you know yourself as well, that of course there were Irish men who joined those forces. Many of them who were killed in 1921, for example, I've come across just this morning, three examples: Robert Hegarty, Michael Doyle, Joseph Burke, Irish men in the RIC, who had only joined in the previous few months when it was quite clear you weren't joining a police force to hunt down poteen makers. You were joining a police force that was engaged in putting down a rebellion. These people were combatants then. They were not, you know, ordinary policemen.
The comparison, Jim, that was made was that would you, if you were an Indian, would you, in commemorating Amritsar, would you commemorate General Dyer, and would you commemorate the British soldiers, or some of them I'm sure would have been Irish soldiers, I mean Dyer had his Irish connections as well, who actually fired on the innocent civilians in Amritsar?
The only ones that we wanted to remember was those other than the Black and Tans and the Auxiliaries.
But you can't be that selective, Jim. I mean, if you're commemorating the RIC, you're commemorating them all.
They were Irishmen killed by Irishmen. How are we going to
But we're not all the police fatalities going to be commemorated, because there was this distinction made in January. At least 150 of the RIC's fatalities were Black and Tans or Auxiliaries. And that's only the foreign-born, I mean, or the British-born. There's a good few Irish names on top of that. If you joined the police in January 1921 and you were Irish, you were technically a Black and Tan or an Auxiliary, because you were usually an ex-soldier. So were you actually going to then only commemorate 300 dead or 250 dead? It seemed clear to me that you were commemorating all the
RIC fatalities.
I
want to bring in Katrina here, because I think what we've just heard perhaps justifies something, or begins to justify something that you said when you were interviewed by Tommy Tiernan on his program on TV, where you said you're not a great fan of the notion of commemoration at all. Now, there are a lot of people, I think, listening to the discussion that's taken place so far will think, she has a point there.
Well, it inevitably causes trouble. And it's also pietistic to a degree. It's always going to cause controversy and difficulty unless it's handled with extreme skill. And the Department of Justice, saving their presence, are renowned for one thing particularly. They don't listen to anybody. They didn't listen to any of the small towns in Ireland where they decided to put in direct provision centres, where if they had consulted people in advance, they would probably have welcomed the newcomers without the fuss that arose because they wouldn't listen. In this situation, they didn't listen to their own expert advisory group on commemorations, who would, had they been asked, said, we don't think that would work. We think it might be better to have a large conference on the police force in general and its activities and composition during this period. A very good idea, something we could all do with. Instead, what we get is a lot of... I listened to the radio for a week after the whole thing happened, and some of the extensive outrage that was being yelled at me from the airways was very dismaying. It also... I'm taking Brian's point, I'm taking Jim's points about the composition of the police force at the different times that it was there. But it seemed to be impossible for anybody shouting from the rooftops that this was the SS being commemorated, for example, which is a ridiculous claim to make, that they couldn't imagine that they themselves, had they been alive at the time, might have been an RIC constable in a small barracks in some part of the country, in a dire situation with probably a wife and three or four children in the barracks down the road or in housing down the road, trying to deal with this, possibly having had two or three black and tans foisted in on top of them in 1920 when they started to come. What are they supposed to do? I mean, it is romantic in the extreme to think that everyone is going to throw up their job, the only job they have, with a reasonable salary.
And many did.
Supporting their families. Many did, sure. But not everyone is able to do that and join the IRA and fight for Ireland. Life is not like that. Now, there is a definite issue about the black and tans and the auxiliaries versus the RIC, although it shades in different directions. Some RIC men we know misbehaved very, very badly during the War of Independence, did things they shouldn't have done, as indeed did the IRA, in case we forget. It's not as if we're looking at Seagreen incorruptibles who behaved themselves like angels throughout the War of Independence, or indeed when we turn on each other in the Civil War. So if we could all calm down a bit about the atrocity level and who did what, and start to think about if we do want to satisfy a number of constituencies here, in terms of, I would prefer terms like reflection and interrogation and scholarship, all of that, and respect and dignity rather than commemoration. Can we come to a situation where we can deal with the different shades of activity, opinion and behaviour in the police force at this time? We know the DMP was a completely different animal to the RIC at the time, for all kinds of reasons. We know that the RIC was largely a different thing to the Black and Tans, and the Black and Tans were a different thing to the auxiliaries. All of that deserves to be examined and looked at in detail. The conference that was proposed by the advisory committee is probably the best solution to that.
Well, okay, the advisory committee used the term commemoration. I think that has to be said, to be fair. And some of them then wrote back and said that isn't what they meant. We've forgotten the other part of the RIC, the Ulster Special Constabulary. I mean, a lot of the debate was very partitionist, I found. People were talking about the RIC as if they only existed in Cork or Kerry or Dublin. The RIC existed in Belfast as well, and in Derry and elsewhere. And by the winter of 1920, they're augmented by the Ulster Special Constabulary. And in Richard Abbott's book of casualties, he includes specials as, you know, their fatalities as well. And that's a hugely controversial force to talk about in this context.
OK, should we
too.
Be talking at this stage about state commemoration versus private commemoration? Because what Jim described at the beginning was a very dignified annual commemoration conducted by a private group, you know, in a public setting, in a public forum. People can come, they can go, you know, they can as they please. We have a great tradition, whether we like it or not, in this country of hiving things off to the private sector. So, at this stage, should we hive all commemoration off to the private sector, as it were, and leave it to groups like HAARP, for example, to do their thing?
Can't we look at what we did in 2016, which worked perfectly well? Now, 1916
is not
in any way
well.
As controversial, but there were a lot of local groups supported by local authorities allowed to carry out their own events around the country, which they did so with gusto. They engaged hugely. I think there's huge scope for that, particularly in relation to the War of Independence.
Yeah, but we still had soldiers and planes in O'Connell Street.
I think there is a context, though. It is not... This history is not just a collection of tragedies. I mean, I think Jim's work and the work that people have done on the individual stories of all these people is fantastic, and we should. One of the triumphs of the decade of commemorations has been, for example, the opening up of the military service pension files and so on, which have really, you know, given us a great deal of the real story of people's lives. But there's a broader story. And I think, you know, in 2016, President Michael D. Higgins talked about imperialism, imperial triumphalism, you know, self-determination. A lot of Irish historians, I find, are very, very wary of using terms like that. We're not simply dealing with a history of tragedies here. We're dealing with an attempt at self-determination by a country in which the majority of nationalists, from the most moderate home ruler to the most radical separatist, regarded as being oppressed. And this state came about through that struggle. So I think that the state does need to take ownership of that and actually commemorate it in a different way than it would the people who ended up on the other side. Because people did have a choice. Okay, there was agency.
I can give a few examples of the formula that we are using by just inviting people who are connected, say, to RIC, to our event. Mm. Now, and the one in particular in Dublin Castle, we tracked down relatives of Constable James O'Brien. The British ambassador came. And we were walking away from it when this young girl came up and asked, could she put down a bunch of flowers? And we said, how are you connected? And she said, I'm not. I'm connected to the man that killed them. Mm-hmm. So that's it's gone to a new generation and the initiative is coming from them. So that's a very good example.
Okay, that's an example of reconciliation, and it's vitally important. But did we also miss a trick in the sense that by not having any form of commemoration, whatever, for the RIC, we have missed out, in a sense, commemorating the achievements of Ned Broy, David Neligan, McNamara, Kavanagh, DMP men who were vital to Collins's intelligence operation, and to probably, I would say, Brian, hundreds of RIC men around the country who wanted to resign but were told not to resign, mm-hmm. so that they could work with the... I mean, I know in my own county, for example, I suspect that in Dunshaughlin in County Meath, half the RIC and the RIC barracks in Dunshaughlin in County Meath were passing information to the IRA. Did we miss a trick there?
Well, it would be a very different type of commemoration, because then we would be saying that, yes, the RIC who sided with the Irish Republican effort are something different to those who didn't.
Well, clearly I think they are.
Yeah, and there's a reluctance to do that, though. You know, the idea of the Glasnevin Wall, for example, in 2016, I said on several occasions, by 2020, are you going to put black and tans and auxiliary fatalities on that wall? Nobody could say whether they were or not. Now, the logic is we put everybody there. Now, that seems to be fine reconciliation. Everybody suffered, all these people died. But actually, one side was fighting to impose a rule which had been rejected by the majority. And are we the only place in the world that has an equivalence in how we deal with that? Because lots of places have gone through reconciliation processes and former enemies have sat down and talked to each other. But they haven't all agreed then that actually you were right along.
But they were the terms of reference that was, I can just quote from it, recognising the importance of adopting a respectful and sensitive approach to the remembrance of the historical events of the period, which focuses on reconciliation and remembrance of all those who suffered and lost their lives.
Yeah, but Jim, it's important, I think, also to point out that we're not, and perhaps some people did think that this is what we were dealing with, we're not talking about commemorating a force that's anything like the Garda Síochána that we have at the moment. The RIC were very, very different.
Very different. Yeah, and just as regards spies and that, in 1923, the commission that was set up for those ex-RIC men who were dismissed or could prove that they resigned for Republican reasons, 986 applied, 490 actually got pensions. That'll tell you
that's a figure I would have expected, something over the order of 400 or 500. But to come back to the nature of this force, DMP were by and large an unarmed force. They were armed with revolvers, as it happens during the War of Independence, after a number of their members had been, plainclothes members had been murdered by the squad and others. But the RIC, from time immemorial, the RIC was a force that assisted at evictions. The RIC was a force that was, the R in the RIC comes about as a consequence of it putting down the Fenian Rebellion in 1867. Yeah. It's an army, basically.
Yeah, it's an army.
And it would have been seen by many as an army of occupation. Yeah. So why would we commemorate an organisation like that?
I think that's a bit extreme. Seen by many as an army of occupation. Maybe it was seen as that in 1920.
No, I mean, in fairness, it was a lot more than
that. It was a model for colonial policing. Katrina, you were wrong.
Well, all right, they were the sons and daughters of people in this country who were delighted to get jobs like that. And, that, you know, that, not everyone that spends their lives thinking anything. About colonial oppression. Also, just to take your other point about people seeming to forget this is not a history of tragedies. Yes, it is. We're looking at an appalling decade in terms of loss in this country between the First World War, 1916, the War of Independence and the Civil War. A lot of people died. A lot of people lost their loved ones. And that matters. And it didn't matter for a very long time when we were glorifying the success of the state in achieving independence, which I rejoice in, of course. But we've done that. We've been there. We have done it forever.
Well, you see, the
since
problem...
Since I was a small child, I've been told these were the great
Well, you
era.
See, since I was a small child, we weren't told that because the political atmosphere changed greatly in the 1970s and 1980s. And a lot of Irish historians and commentators are still refighting that. And that what a lot of historians were very worried about 2016. And they thought it went very well because they somehow thought 2016 could restart the Northern Troubles because 1966 somehow started them. And I completely reject that idea. I think that we're in a completely different historical context now. But I think it is important. The RIC were a model for colonial policing. They were not an ordinary police force. And if you look at any colonial situation, at Amritsar, for example, as you mentioned, Miles, most of those soldiers who fired on the people were Sikhs or Gurkhas. They were locally recruited soldiers. Mm. The British Empire always recruited among it simply wasn't big, hadn't a big enough army to police the empire itself.
Okay, well, let me put the other side of the coin of to the question that I put to Jim that Katrina objected to, and that is that the RIC, you're also talking about people who were the statisticians of the Victorian era. These were people who went out on their bicycles and who managed to collect reams and reams of information, which were used to create policy by various governments, some of them Tory governments, for example. And that really is what they were about, far more. I mean, I singled out 1867 and how they got the R in the RIC and all of that kind of stuff. But really what they were about was the local bobby on the bicycle.
One of our greatest sources for Irish political history are the RIC inspectors' reports. Mm-hmm. And these don't just detail local social life or statistics. The RIC had a political role. They are full of reports on who are attending political meetings, who's involved in trade unions, who's involved in land agitation, naturally enough, who's involved in revolutionary organisations, because that was a key part of their job.
As it is and of every police force everywhere, not of the, whether I don't native think, or colonial.
Usually as part of a distinct force like the Special Branch and so on. But the ordinary RIC saw their role as essentially policing Ireland.
Oh, for sure.
And when they were faced with a choice, you know, about self-determination, some made the choice of leaving the force, some worked for the IRA, and some stayed loyal. And that's something we have to understand as well. There is agency here. It's not just about poor men caught in a situation not of their own making. Young Irish men who joined the RIC in 1920, 1921 are making a decision about what side they're on. Again, my own namesake, Jim has studied him, Thomas Hanley from County Limerick, a former soldier, joins the Black and Tans in 1920 because of local clashes with the IRA. I'm sure he felt he had a good reason for doing so, but he made a choice.
Katrina, where does this leave us when it comes to future acts of commemoration? Where does it leave us, when it comes to even something like commemorating Kilmichael in November of this year? God knows, Bloody Sunday, the two parts of Bloody Sunday, not just what happened in Croke Park, but what happened in the morning of Bloody Sunday. And God forbid, where does it leave us when it comes to commemorating elements and aspects of the Civil War?
It's a mess.
If we can't even do this.
It's going to be very difficult. And I think we have to again go back to ideas of mutual respect and some sense of dignity about how we approach all this. This is all 100 years ago. Brian is right to say that it led to the formation of an independent state, which then went into civil war. If you want to get somewhere, I wouldn't start from there. There are those who would also argue that our independent state ended up being the state that incarcerated women and children to an alarming and unprecedented degree compared to anywhere else in Europe for a very, very long time. Did we get what people wanted? Probably not. But who are the people? How does that work? We need to be thinking far more about the ideologies that underlay the so-called decade of revolution, I would argue. If it was a revolution, it led to a very conservative outcome. What actually was happening to people at that time, instead of reading history backwards? Yes, there was agency and choice, but it might not have looked like that, Brian, at the time to certain people. We can't forget the economic drivers that apply to people's lives, particularly about being able to get a job where you're being paid money. We went through many, many years of amnesia about World War One, and an opprobrium for people whose ancestors had fought in it. You were one of the people, Miles, who opened that discussion up for public debate. We're not celebrating a very, very stupid war by saying we can acknowledge the ancestors of those who fought in World War One. That has become something now that's commonplace that we can all talk about with a certain degree of mutual respect and with sadness for the fact that so many young men and civilians were killed.
Basically in relation to even World War One, 752 RIC men volunteered for service, 176 were killed. And there's no memorial to policemen even killed in World War One, isn't
there? It's never been debated. There are, at this stage around the country, Jim,
I think there's only nine buried in Ireland.
We put that one to bed by now.
Not in relation to policemen.
Well, not in relation to specific professions or specific occupations. Yeah. You know, I think maybe in Guinness's there's probably a memorial.
Guinness's have their own road of honour. Yeah. It's, you know, that's the way it goes. Mm. Guinness's was
the individuals involved have been, you know, duly recognised in commemoration that took place between 2014 and 2018. But Brian, let me put the same question to you that I put to Katrina. Where does this leave us with future commemorations? You know, I mean, obviously the Department of Justice have had their fingers badly burned on this one. And, you know, I can't see.
Well, firstly, I think we can't sleepwalk. And I think that's what happened. People thought 2016 went extremely well because it didn't reactivate a conflict that it was never going to reactivate. And therefore, they thought, well, we'll just keep commemorating everything and all sides will be happy. We'll nod to the unionists, we'll nod to the police, we'll nod to the Republicans and so on. And I think we need to disagree. 100 years ago, Irish people profoundly disagreed to the point that they were obviously prepared to kill each other. You know, and we need to look back. We need to know why they were prepared to do that, the myriad of reasons why they did so, the complexities, the bad things that happened. But also then, I think, look at this as part of a global story. Why were there people in Egypt and India and so on so interested in Ireland? And why did they think the measure of independence that was achieved was so significant for them? You know, and they weren't looking, of course, at the minutiae of how conservative it was all becoming. They were saying the British Empire has been rocked by this, something that looked impossible a decade before. And I think there is some cause for celebration in that. You don't have to celebrate every single incident. You don't have to deny the pain and tragedy that was inflicted on people. But you also have to look at this as a story of, you know, a place that had been denied self-determination actually beginning to win it.
Okay, I can say with some degree of confidence this is not the last time we'll be having a conversation like this. I'm sure Jim Hurley, Brian Hanley and Katrina Crowe, thank you very much indeed for joining us this evening. And on the subject of the War of Independence, I want to say a quick word about something for perhaps your diary in March, the middle to the end of March, a festival which is focusing this year on various aspects of that conflict. The History Show is delighted to be collaborating with the Hinterland Festival in Kells in a new venture, a festival of history called Hindsight, from the 20th to the 22nd of March. Over the weekend, some of the best-known authorities on the Anglo-Irish War, many of whom featured in our 10-part series last year, will share their knowledge of this pivotal, compelling and, as we've just heard, still controversial period of Irish history. They include people like John Borgonovo, Linda Connolly, Andy Bielenberg, Páraig O'Rourke, Katrina Crowe, and our own Liz Gillis of The History Show. Some of the issues that are going to be explored will include the issue of the disappeared, bodies that have not been brought back to their families, the intelligence war, allegations of IRA ethnic cleansing, the controversial Dublin IRA attack on the Custom House in May 1921, and assaults on women by the IRA and by the Crown Forces. A panel discussion on Saturday, the 21st of March, will offer assistance to anyone who wants to use online resources to trace the activities of members of their extended families during the 1916 to 23 period. You can visit hinterland.ie now for details on booking for Hindsight events, and we'll also put a link on our own website. So that's the Hindsight Festival, 20th to the 22nd of March. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back after these.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
And welcome back to the History Show on RTE Radio 1. Now, as we've just been talking about the Royal Irish Constabulary, we're going to hear a story that further illustrates the role of that police force in Irish history. It takes place in Donegal in February of 1889 and involves a violent altercation that occurred when a party of RIC officers was sent to arrest the local parish priest, Father James McFadden. McFadden was a famous figure in the land campaign, a strong-minded man who was well known for opposing evictions. Our reporter Mark McMenamin has the story.
We're at St Anne's Church in Ballyshannon, at the top of the town, or the head of the town, as we say around here. We're standing in the graveyard and we're very close to a monument. The monument is pink granite. It's quite impressive. It's to one William Limerick Martin, a district inspector.
Brian Drummond is a local historian and author. He, like myself, has long been curious about the case of slain RIC officer William Limerick Martin.
It's been erected by his sorrowful wife, or sorrowful widow on the monument, it says. And the monument tells he was cruelly murdered in Derry Begwithore whilst nobly carrying out his duty.
I asked Brian what brought Inspector Martin to Derry Beg that day and why he was arresting Father McFadden.
He was part of a group of RIC men gathered essentially from around the country to go to Gwydor to arrest a priest, the famous Father McFadden, the fighting priest of Donegal, also known as Ansagart Mór, the great priest. He'd been involved in land agitation down in the west of the county for a number of years. There's an incident, and in the incident, Martin is essentially wounded or hurt and dies later that day.
The events of that day are contested, depending, of course, on which sources are consulted.
So, basically, in 1889, William Limerick Martin went with a group of RIC constables to arrest the fighting priest of Gwydor, James McFadden.
Journalist Dean Ruxton is curator of the Lost Leeds feature in the Irish Times. Dean has researched how the case was reported by the papers of the day.
He was charged at the time with conspiracy under the Crimes Act 1887, which was a piece of legislation designed to give more power to the authorities when it came to dealing with land agitation and stuff like that, any agrarian crime.
After Sunday Mass on February 3rd, 1889, the party of RIC constables lined up outside the chapel.
The parishioners kind of hung around to see what was going on, and when he came out, then they went from there, grabbed him. Pretty quickly then they acted, the parishioners acted, so there was a boundary wall being built at the time, or had just been built, and there was granite, and all the newspaper, the contemporary reports at the time mentioned granite strewn about the yard, and they picked them up and threw them at the police. This is the stones. They pulled up sticks, paling stakes, and they defended their parish priest.
In the ensuing melee, Father McFadden escaped from Martin's grasp.
Essentially he wriggled free. He ran across the churchyard to try to get to his parochial house. There was a short flight of stairs leading up to the parochial house. And William Martin grabbed him just before he made the stairs. And this is when he was wounded in what would be a fatal wound. The exact circumstance of what happened, there's a bit of debate. One report said he was hit with a stone, fell forward and broke his nose, never again consciousness. There was another one said he was hit with a stick. So basically, blunt force, a blunt instrument.
Inspector Martin's injuries were severe and fatal. The official record simply states that he had a head injury and died.
At one point it was said that his face was unrecognisable. He was quite badly injured. Then he lingered for a while. He died later on that day at about 2:45 p.m, one report said. But as soon as that happened, McFadden surrendered. The crowd dispersed.
In the end, Father McFadden was arrested and put on trial. At a hearing on February 11th, the initial charge of conspiracy was dropped and replaced with a murder charge.
His counsel was outraged at that because he figured the conspiracy charge was trumped up, then replacing with this invented murder charge was the word he used. Eventually he made a deal after about 2 weeks. The deal made, he pleaded guilty to obstructing the police. Seven other people received manslaughter sentences, and the worst was a guy called William Call. He got 10 years penal servitude.
Father James McFadden was moved to the parish of Glenties in the south of County Donegal. In the following years, a memorial was erected to Inspector Martin in St Anne's Church in Ballyshannon. In many ways, this case highlights the current political dilemma of how best to commemorate the Royal Irish Constabulary.
It's like all things in Irish history. There's no clear perspective on it. And I suppose if you're going to honour it, you have to recognise what their function was in the country. You have to discuss that piece of it. Martin did actually give his life on duty. The circumstances of it, for instance, in one of the reports, it talks about Martin drawing his sword and starting off the configuration, whatever it is. But that's, he said, they said, whatever. There are lots of guys who gave their life in the line of duty. You have to recognise that. We're always judging history from now, but you have to go back to then. Where were they? What had they got to do? And bear in mind, probably for 90% of the time, their duties were just communal guard and police duties. But then when times came to be, they were there on behalf of the state.
Historian Brian Drummond there, ending that report from Mark McMenamin on the death of RIC Inspector William Limerick Martin. We're going to take a quick break now. When we return, we'll be looking at the history of television in Ireland.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
Welcome back to the History Show on RTE Radio 1. Television has been a part of Irish life for nearly 70 years now. A new book by Edward Brennan reconsiders the role of television in social change. An important aspect of this work is people's memories of television when they were growing up. I'll be talking to the author in a moment. But first, let's hear some of those memories. Our producer, Lorcan Clancy, went to Lanesborough County, Longford, and asked people what they remember about the arrival of this new medium.
My first memory of a television, we didn't understand anything about television, was in a bicycle and radio shop in the 50s. I would have been a teenager. But he had this thing in a corner. You could hear just a very, very faint sound. No picture, just fog.
I think every neighbour around the place had a television before we had. Of course, we used to be rambling into different houses at different stages and the telly would be turned on.
We didn't get one at home until we were 14, but we used to go up to our neighbours, the Finnegans, and we used to watch it there. And on a Saturday, we'd be watching The Virginian. It was a great Western, black and white, of course.
The programme I remember most as a child was Wanderley Wagon, which was on RTE back in the late 60s when I was a child.
Maybe around 1965, I bought a second-hand television, which, must say, ran for several years. This was at a time when the throwaway society hadn't arrived. And so when you got something, you held on to it, and if it broke down, you got it repaired and could get it repaired.
Larkin, I was a nurse, and in those days, we did not have time to watch television. I don't even believe that there was a television in the nurse's home where I lived. That is 50 years ago.
People used to be able to get BBC a bit, but it had the snow effect. But it didn't deter people from watching programmes on it because it was always exciting to see this newfangled thing called television, you know.
If there was a kiss or something on the television between two of the actors in whatever show we were watching, and we'd all start giggling and laughing, and then we'd want to practice on one another. It was the nearest we got to a blue movie in them days.
I think it was only turned on in the evening time, maybe. As people thought that it was going to use up an awful lot of electricity and stuff like that, you know. They were half afraid of it, most of them.
And was there still only one channel in those days?
Yes, only the one, yeah. But we're so lucky to have the one. We were delighted. We were made up.
And there were some memories of television in the 1950s and 60s. With me here in studio is Edward Brennan, lecturer at TU Dublin and the author of the book A Post-Nationalist History of Television in Ireland. You're very welcome.
Thanks,
Eddie, we just heard a sample of memories there. Tell us why talking to people about their experiences of television growing up was such an important part of your research.
It was important because when I've been teaching media history for a number of years in DIT, now TU Dublin, and it struck me as I was teaching that there was quite a mainstreaming sort of effect in the histories that were there. There were sort of putting forward the same narrative more or less all the time. And when I looked at it, there is a sort of a dominant narrative in the history of television in Ireland, which we might get a chance to talk about shortly. But I guess the key thing is that they're based in institutional sources. So when you base your histories in institutional sources, you get quite a limited picture of what's going on. And you get to, I suppose, the title of the book, A Post-Nationalist History, you get an essentially nation-state-shaped picture of what's going on with television. So when you talk to people then, you get far more diversity, as you can hear from the Vox Pop. People have very, very different memories of what television was about. But you also get diversity in the sense that you see that people in different areas had different experiences of television. There wasn't a homogeneous national audience. Women had different experiences to men, so on and so forth. And the other thing you saw is that the history of television in Ireland was very much about imported programmes, about British broadcasts and so on. So you very much get a history of the medium as opposed to history of RTE, for example, which is what most histories written in Ireland so far have looked at.
Just go back to pre-RTE and, I'm old enough to remember days before RTE television, not that many of them, but would the history of television in Ireland be very different in the part of the country where I came from, which was very, very near the border, and if you were living in Kenmare, for example?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things is that the rollout of RTE was very slow across the country. So people in parts of Kerry and so on were still getting reliable coverage in the 70s and 80s. So there was that difference. The other thing is that Meath and so on would have been within range of the Divis transmitter, which started up in 1955. You would have had UTV that came online in 1959. So in Meath, you would have had pretty reliable television coverage from the mid-50s onwards. So a very different experience of television again to people living in Cork or Kerry, for example.
It was also, one gets the impression from that Vox Pop, from those people in Lanesborough, that it was more of a social thing, that if you didn't have a television, you weren't necessarily completely disadvantaged.
You could go next door. Well, you could be disadvantaged, because one of the things was that there was a lot of collective viewing. So as people put it, if you had a television, you wouldn't be allowed to keep it to yourself, that the neighbours would be in and they'd be watching it and so on. And you get lots of stories about people going to their uncle's houses, friends' houses, or a pub, as the case may be, and so on. And so people very much practiced collective viewing and so on. And then on the other hand, people could be at a loss because the neighbours would invite themselves in. And as one woman said, someone from a working class background living in the centre of Dublin said that the neighbours would simply invite themselves in. This was in the 1950s. They'd invite themselves in and you couldn't really turn them away. And so they had to be entertained. There had to
and
be
then you'd have to give them a cup of tea and a few sandwiches.
And so on. And so, as this woman put it, her husband would be going without meat in his sandwiches that week because they had to entertain the neighbours.
And did it also change the use of space, the shape of houses, certainly the use of spaces in houses?
Yeah, I mean, there's a very interesting statement from Mrs. Frances Condell, who was the mayor of Limerick in 1962. She talks about how corporations would need to reconsider the design of houses because we had to face up to the fact that every modern family would now watch television. In Levittown, the famous American mass-produced suburb, they installed the television as standard from 1950. So there was this sense that the television was constructed within media and so on, has been very much the heart of family activity, very much the heart of the modern home. And so that was put across through media. But then in practice as well, people changed the way they use their houses. They changed the way they use the home. So the whole idea of the good room was quite common for a lot of people. And the television then got in the way of keeping a room empty. And so sometimes people gave up the good room and turned the good room into a dining room, or they merged the dining room with the sitting room or whatever the case may be. One of the interesting things that happened was, in speaking to people, there seemed to be something of a taboo in the 50s and 60s about mixing food with watching television. It was seen by some people to be very bad form, to be quite poor manners to eat in front of the television set. So people might have a dining room, which they would then reconfigure in order to watch television later in the evening, but they wouldn't eat in front of the set. And so one of the things that seems to happen then over time is that space in the home becomes casualised, that people, a lot of people in the 50s seem to have quite clear functions for different rooms. But then over time, people would bring the odd snack in front of the television. One day in the week, they might have their tea in front of the television. And then over time, there's televisions in kitchens, televisions in bedrooms, and so on. And so the use of space.
And does the good room disappear?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, how many? The good room now is quite a rare
occurrence.
And of course, there's a class element too. So some people could keep a good room and a sitting room for reading in and have a dedicated television room, where I spoke to people like there might be more than 10 people living in a flat in the middle of Dublin, and they sat where they could and at their dinner in front of the screen and so on.
And did it kill conversation or did it spark conversation, even if the conversation was only about, you know, how bad was the bad guy in the Virginian?
I think it did both. I mean, it did both. That one of the things that came across, and you have to bear in mind there may be an element of nostalgia attached to this, but people talked about neighbouring and so on, and how after that era of television being a new thing and calling down to the uncle or the neighbour or whatever to see the television, once everybody had their own television, there was a sense that people didn't need each other as much, particularly country people, that, you know, you wouldn't walk the half mile to the neighbour because maybe they didn't want to see you when you got there. They were more interested in the screen and so on. On the other hand, then, so there was that there was less neighbouring, but then television became a form of social capital. It became the stuff of conversation, and it became something you had to be up to speed with. So people talking about things like The Fugitive, you know, you couldn't go to work, and particularly people talking about going to school, you couldn't be on the school bus and not have seen The Fugitive because you had to be up to speed with what was going on that week, and so on. So television became, I suppose, part of what people talk about now is that the water cooler conversation became part of what was going on.
But was there as much conversation about The Fugitive as there was about what was being discussed on The Late Late Show, for example?
There was at one stage a crossover where the key detective from the Fugitive appeared on The Late Late Show. So I think you're talking about two very different types of things. But I mean, like The Fugitive, the final episode of The Fugitive in 1967 was absolutely central to people's conversations. People talked about how the streets were empty and so on. They were struck by the power of television. I think part of what was going on there as well is that Ireland had always been behind the times when it came to popular culture, particularly popular culture coming from America. So quite often, Westerns and so on that we were watching were already cancelled in America. They were 2 or 3 years old. The final episode of The Fugitive appeared on RTÉ a day after it had appeared.
Don't give away the ending.
A day after it had appeared in America and a day before UTV had it. So that was massive. But then the type of conversations facilitated by things like The Late Late Show and television drama and so on had perhaps a far deeper significance in terms of media history in Ireland.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us. And the book is called A Post-Nationalist History of Television in Ireland, published by Palgrave. If you want to pick up the book at a much reduced price of £9.99, you can do so only this Friday, 6th of March, on the Palgrave website, where they'll be running a deal of the day promotion. And just before we go, a text. One way, says Larry Dunn, to resolve the commemoration mess: the state withdraws from all such events for now. Let those who choose to remember do so on their own terms. 2016 was enough. That's all we've got time for in this evening's programme. Details of all our items, as well as podcasts, are available on our website, rte.ie/historyshow. Thanks to Pather Carney on sound tonight and our researcher, Liz Gillis. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.